Welcome, one and all, to a podcast of the cinema.
Yes. Who are you?
My name is Alonzo Duraldi. I'm film reviews editor for The Wrap and a film critic for What the Flick on the Young Turks Network on YouTube.
I'm Dave White. I ain't nothing. I ain't nobody.
You're plenty. You're plenty O'Toole.
Plenty fat and marbled for the cannibals to consume.
We would both be delicious.
I think so. I would be a real treat for them. They'd be like, it would be like Christmas.
Yeah.
Except they're cannibals, so they probably don't think about that.
Maybe not.
This kind of thing very much.
But, you know, I mean, I'm pretty much the next best
thing.
There should
be a cannibal Christmas movie.
I'm sure, now that you've said it. It's in the universe.
Just like the way that I want there to be a Purge Christmas movie.
Purge Christmas, yes. Maybe a Purge Christmas special.
No, I want a theatrically released Christmas film about the Purge, like a special extra Christmas Purge.
I understand.
And here's the thing about the Purge movies. Ain't nobody doing cannibalism in the Purge movies when it would be totally legal.
Well, maybe they're saving it for a later installment.
For Purge Christmas.
For Purge Christmas.
If anybody has the ear of the Purge people, let them know my thoughts.
Is that Blumhouse?
I don't even need a story credit. What?
Is that Blumhouse?
I don't know.
Because I know somebody at Blumhouse.
They need to tell your Blumhouse's people. Okay, tell your Blumhouse Christmas. Bros that, A, I need a Purge movie annually.
Right.
Like an annual Purge. I need an annual Purge movie. Mm-hmm. And I want a Purge Christmas film.
Okay.
Well, with cannibalism.
Okay. God, you want so much.
I do. I have a lot of demands about life.
I'm trying to live my best life. For cannibals, I would be the next best thing to a goose that has been force-fed acorns.
Yeah.
I am, I don't exercise enough, and I eat a lot of delicious sweet treats.
I don't see you eating a lot of acorns, though.
No, I do not.
So what's up?
I'm not.
When
I'm,
are we gonna?
I'm
let's
not,
get you. Let's get you. You're already Spanish. Let's turn you into an Iberico ham.
You clearly did not watch Hannibal season 3.
I'm behind
because Bedelia was actually eating acorns and drinking Madeira wine.
I'm behind on. I am behind on Hannibal
to make herself tasty.
Catching up on Hannibal, but okay. I'm still behind.
I'm just saying it's been done, the acorn thing.
But in real life,
yeah,
I know. Okay, so I said Linoleum Knife, and you said a podcast of the cinema, and we introduced ourselves.
Right.
And you were just telling me about the Hollywood Reporter situation where the...
Oh, yeah, there's a class action suit
where the freelancers... This is so good.
Freelancers who were, for all intents and purposes, employees, but were not called employees so as to get screwed out of things like benefits and overtime.
I might have had some experience with that sort of thing myself.
I think almost everybody in our line of work has faced that particular molehill over the last decade or so.
I was the sole film critic for a website that must remain nameless. And they... all the things in this Hollywood Reporter class action suit sounded really, really familiar to me and my experiences.
Mm. It's a thing that's happening, you know.
What are the charges that they're not being paid? Not being given benefits. They're being treated like employees.
They were being paid late.
Being paid late. Being probably, perhaps. never given a raise or not being paid anything approaching a living wage. Just guessing.
For instance, grabbing this out of thin air. Yeah. That's you know, Out Magazine, remember? They canned all of their...
I remember Out Magazine.
They canned all of their staff editorial and then suddenly brought them all back as freelancers. Uh-huh.
Oh, yes. No, if you recall, I wrote for their website for a while.
Very crafty.
I know what they're like, or they were like, or maybe they still... I don't know what they're like now.
Who knows how many changes of management they've been through since our era there, but yeah.
I'm really just thinking about that one website that I used to work for. And they were...
Well, you don't anymore.
Yeah. Like, quit. What, speaking of injustices that would make you maybe want to throw a brick.
Wow, that was a smooth segue.
That's why we do what we do for a living. To have these, seamless transitions between topics. You know, I was at Stonewall.
You were five.
I was five. And I just want to clarify that it was, in fact, me who threw that brick as a five-year-old. And I yelled, gay power. Someone said, no, little Dave, that's not the way.
Someone from the Mattachine Society?
Yeah, the Children's Mattachine Society. And I said, it's the only way.
Gay power.
I need a glass of chocolate quick.
Okay, so yeah, Roland Emmerich's Stonewall finally opened this weekend.
Who's excited about listening to us tell you all about it?
Yay.
All right, I'm going to tell you the story. I'll tell you the story of what happens in this movie.
Okay.
All right, so Warhorse goes to school in Indiana.
Right.
He's blonde. He's real pretty.
Real pretty.
Just like he was in the film called Warhorse.
Yes. Although here, Warhorse has almost like a halo effect with his big haystack of blonde hair on top of his head.
I'll tell you, though, he's getting a little older. Because he was like a late teenager or something at the time of the film Warhorse. Mm-hmm. Had those rosy flushed cheeks all the time. Mm-hmm. Those are gone now.
Well,
he's aging into manhood.
They're trying to make him look not British.
Right.
There's a lot of British people in this movie.
There are. He is in love with his fellow football team playmate.
The quarterback.
The quarterback. He's in love. And they drive out to the fields behind a barn somewhere. Mm-hmm. And they do teen sex.
Yes.
Together. The other kids who know them come and find them one night while they're having some teen sex.
They assume that the quarterback is back there with his lady friend.
With his girlfriend. Yeah. But he's actually back there with Warhorse.
Right.
And so, but then the friends find him and they seem a little surprised. I don't know if the look of surprise on their face is, oh, it's two dudes, or if they don't understand the sexual act that's transpiring.
They seem genuinely baffled
in front of them
by what they are witnessing. It's a look that you'll come to know well over the course of watching Stonewall. Yeah. You'll have it yourself. So then the next day, Warhorse comes to school, and they have scrawled faggot on his locker.
Faggot!
And he runs home to find that Dad has packed his suitcase for him and put his not-so-well-hidden Muscle Man magazines in the suitcase very thoughtfully, I thought.
Take your physique pictorials with you.
And Amscray. So Warhorse goes to New York because Warhorse wants to go to Columbia University in the fall. He has gotten a scholarship, apparently.
Right, but it's contingent on his parents signing the papers.
Right.
And they refuse to do it.
Yes.
Because they're that
they're mad.
Horrible.
Yes. So in the meantime,
they are bad at parenting.
He takes the bus into New York City and arrives as a wide-eyed naif and immediately falls in with a cadre of street smart
kids.
Hustlers of various gender stripe representations.
Yeah, it's the film never gets specific about, you know, what gender does this person identify as.
Right.
It's very much a, in fact, their character names are like Ray / Ramona, and no one ever self-identifies either. It's sort of like, well, we're all just queens.
Right.
And so
which to be fair might have been a sort of 1969 nomenclature.
Possibly, yeah. You know. I mean, I was only 5 and throwing a brick.
Yes,
I was.
You
not,
should have taken more notes, frankly.
Yeah.
Of what was happening. I love of the many many brilliantly savage reviews of this movie online. I really enjoy the one from comedian Guy Branum, who also hosts the Pop Rocket podcast. Because he points out the fact that the movie spends an inordinate amount of time making sure that we know the location of Warhorse's suitcase. Like, it is a thing in the movie that is referenced so many times, and it's sort of like, you know, I mean, Roland Emmerich does make action movies, and what's a key element to action movies is knowing where people are in relation to other people.
Yes.
You know, and where events are taking place.
Yeah.
And in this movie, the suitcase is Captain Jack Sparrow. The suitcases, you know, we always know where it is, so we don't have to worry about it, and we
Correct.
Know where it is contingent to the action.
So, you know, he hangs out with Ray / Ramona, played by Johnny Beecham.
From
who's
Penny
on
Dreadful.
Penny Dreadful. I assume he's British?
Yes.
Okay.
And
so is Jeremy Irvine.
Yes, Warhorse.
Who is
and
Warhorse.
So is Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, who will pop up later.
Yeah.
So and of course, it's one of those deals where, you know, Ray / Ramona is
desperately in love.
Desperately in love, hangdog in love with Warhorse, but Warhorse cannot return his feelings because
we don't ever know why.
No, because
it's never explained.
Because presumably,
but there's a,
Warhorse likes him white and masculine,
And or Jonathan Rhys-Meyers.
Well, who next to the street gang comes off at least traditionally male? Let's say.
Yeah. And so, although, again, that's never spoken about either. It is merely an understanding that, of
the course,
you don't get to be loved by
Warhorse.
Twunky little blonde thing.
Dreamy, creamy Warhorse.
You are a Latina drag queen / trans person or something. The film doesn't tell us. And therefore, you get whatever it is that you're going
to
get.
Now, if you do want to see a movie about the Stonewall Riots, where the dreamy, hunky, blonde guy from out of town falls in love with the Latina street drag queen / trans person, I would suggest that you check out the 1995 Stonewall, same title, featuring Mr. Guillermo Diaz, now the star of Scandal.
Same plot as this Stonewall, essentially.
You'd think that being the second movie, a second big narrative film ever made about this one historical event, that John Robin Bates, the playwright who wrote the script,
I just rustled the press notes.
We saved them.
Yeah.
And director Roland Emmerich would maybe find a new way to attack this story, but no. They don't. They follow the same path and do it not as well. What are you sharing?
Well, first of all, related to the 1995 film, Mr. Emmerich has been quoted as saying that when he learned about Stonewall, here's the quote, "Someone should make a movie about this." Well, it turns out,
a funny thing,
somebody did make a movie about this, and they called it Stonewall, and then somebody made a documentary about this, too, and they called it Stonewall Uprising. Here. Allow me to do a little dramatic reading.
Radio theater.
Of the press notes.
Please.
Director and producer Roland Emmerich first became interested in making a movie about the Stonewall Riots when he was taking a tour of the Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Center with producer Michael Fawcett. Emmerich was awestruck by the statistic that 40% of homeless youth in the United States are LGBTQ. Emmerich knew he wanted to help the cause and began thinking about how he could use his skills as a filmmaker to bring more attention to this problem. Out of that came an interest, Emmerich explains. I began reading about Stonewall. What struck me was that there was a story in there, which I felt had an important message. It's the people who had the least to lose who did the fighting, not the politically active people. It was the kids that went to this club that consisted of hustlers and scare queens. Okay, now, I don't know what a scare queen is, and perhaps I'm ignorant and I need to be educated about this term, but I've been Googling the term scare queen and can't come up with anything.
I never heard of it until it was used in conjunction with this movie.
I find this baffling, and I would love it if... Is there anyone out there who knows what this is supposed to mean? Because I'm...
Do we have evidence that Roland Emmerich didn't make this term up?
If I am ignorant of something I should not be ignorant of,
please
I want
tell
to know.
Us.
All right.
We want to know.
This club that consisted of hustlers and scare queens and all kinds of people that you think would never resist the police, and they did. In one of the books about Stonewall, there was this comment by a Black Panther who visited on the third day of the riots, and he said he was amazed that the femme, meaning the most feminine kids, fought the hardest. That was when Emmerich knew that someone had to tell this story, and it was going to be him.
Oh, God.
Yes.
With a lead character who was neither femme nor person
right.
of color.
Yeah.
Now, okay. The complaints have been coming out of the woodwork this week. If anybody who dares say that this movie is, quote-unquote, whitewashing history by virtue of its white masculine leading man. And some people claim, no, that's how it was. It was mostly white guys at Stonewall, and the trans communities exaggerated their presence, and blah, 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 meow, meow, meow.
That came out kind of mush-mouthy right there.
Well, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, that they're arguing that there were a majority of white people there, and that the trans community is appropriating the event and overstating their presence.
So let's just say, for the sake of argument, that that's true. This is still a terrible movie. It's so misbegotten in so many ways. This fictional character that's supposed to be our segue into the story is such a nothing, is so bland and, two-dimensional, and his coming out story feels like the cobbled together after school special version of this whole thing. On top of that...
What's an after school special, Alonzo?
Right, sorry.
For our young listeners who
young listeners,
don't know what that means.
In the 1970s, mostly ABC. They're the ones who had the term after school special, but other networks had their own version sometimes. Would occasionally do weekday afternoon programming that was aimed at middle and high school students, usually about pressing issues of the day, like teen alcoholism or parental abuse or divorce. Or,
PCP with Helen Hunt.
For example.
Yeah.
So it's a very flat and pedestrian character who takes up an astonishing amount of screen time
for a
movie that's about an actual historical event. And it was shot in Montreal.
Okay.
And
so we're moving on to the production values.
Oh yeah, I'm just going down the list now.
A list of complaints.
Yes. the critics who said that this movie looks like it was set on Sesame Street are not wrong.
They are absolutely correct.
It is this.
I've read that in two places.
I've seen it in three or four. Yeah. It's this sort of one artificial block with enough foliage in the trees in October or whatever.
No, that doesn't bother me.
Well,
foliage doesn't bother me.
The foliage is there to hide the fact that you can't see the Manhattan skyline.
Well, yeah.
And you know, there's all these sort of tableau of the hustlers hanging out on the stoop in such a stylized way that I kept thinking that I was watching Hair, and that any moment they were going to like launch into, you know, Manchester, England or something.
Like even worse, Rent.
Yes.
Yeah.
You'll note we stopped recapping the plot because it's just too banal. But it basically involves he gets to New York and he has to let men pay him to have sex, but he cries when they do it because ew. And there's like a Ron Perlman runs the Stonewall and
he's playing a real historical character.
Yeah, But the movie treats him like a monster.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, here's the thing.
Which he may well have
that
been
guy kind of sort of apparently was.
I see.
Back then, like he pimped out those kids.
Yeah. But then there's this whole weird like Interpol subplot that gets thrown up. That's like, wait, what?
Yeah.
What does this do with Stonewall?
Well, apparently there's some historical truth to all of that. Apparently, part of the raid did involve the idea of going after this one guy. Murphy, his last name,
I
Murphy.
I believe Ed Murphy.
You might look that up.
I don't have my...
And...
I'll look in the press notes.
Yeah. Who was a closeted, it
Ed
turned
Murphy,
out.
Yes.
Yeah, it was. He was a closeted gay man. No one knew he was gay at the time, but he was sort of being a kind of being a pimp. That's my understanding. I don't have his historical facts in front of me, but I've read enough about him to know that he is a controversial figure to this day.
I see.
Eventually, he came out and
became like
and
activist.
Became an activist. Yeah, but not.
I will say
before he did a lot of like shady, unsavory, terrible things.
The thing is, though, the way it's presented in this film, it just he feels like this sort of cardboard villain.
Yeah, he's the boogeyman in the movie.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. He turns out Warhorse makes him go be a prostitute for
a creepy client who it is suggested was involved with the murder of at least one other, if not several other
hustlers.
Yeah.
So, eventually, there's another raid, and this is the raid that gets everybody finally ready to fight. A couple things. You say enough with recapping of the plot, but I think recapping the plot is kind of important here because the plot is so poorly, you know, laid out before you in terms of what were the reasons for these people, you know, finally saying enough is enough.
Right.
And so it is
they trot out the Judy Garland theory.
Yeah, which is that's actually my favorite theory. the Judy Garland theory is my favorite one. The one that suggests that because Judy Garland had just died and her funeral was either that day or the day before, that everyone was extra angry.
By the way, I was wrong. It was August, not October.
Yeah. So. And so, August, not October.
Before I was saying about the foliage in October, but August is when all this happened.
No. It all happens in like March, April, May.
No, he arrives 3 months before the riots happen,
which is in June.
Hang on.
Do you even calendar, bro?
I thought this was August 25th, 1969 was the date. Oh no, it is June. You're right, because the parade's always in June. Okay, I'm uncomfortably hot.
Did you eat part of the sleep brownie?
I wish we had a sleep. Sorry.
So, okay. Where was I?
The movie doesn't really explain why this night, why
it
this...
It doesn't explain explicitly the horror, the terror, the anxiety, the misery, the fear of being gay before gay rights came along.
It touches on the existence of the Mattachine Society, and Frank Kameny talks about not being able to work for NASA because he wasn't allowed to have security clearance.
Who was Frank Kameny?
Man.
Explain Frank Kameny.
Frank Kameny was
A real guy.
A real guy who had indeed been a government employee who was fired because at the time all gay people were thought to be a security risk.
Yes.
And he was one of the founders of the Mattachine Society, which was an early gay rights organization, and their deal was very much, whenever you see those old pictures of people protesting
in suits and
suits and ties in front of the State Department with, you know, homosexuals deserve the right to da da da, that was the Mattachine Society.
Those signs actually have Downton Abbey accents.
And it's weird because the movie is basically saying, well, yeah, Mattachine Society, that's nice, but really, you know, power to the people. But the thing is, the film's general attitude is so, like, power to the straight-looking white guy that it's no better than the Mattachine Society that it's pretending is like was too wimpy for this right. moment in history.
Yes. So the movie is
kowtowing to what will straight people think in the way that it's accusing the Mattachine Society of doing. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. It doesn't lay out its case very well. And then there is the moment where the riot begins. And of course, the war horse throws the first brick, and someone says, "No, that's not the way." And he goes, "It's the only way." Ah,
gay power.
Gay power. Throw the brick. Handed to him by a black person.
Right. And so, this is after Ray/Ramona has everybody do this sort of like fashion show runway walk out of the Stonewall in a very 90s kind of way, up to and including a Toys R Us reference.
Yes.
Which I looked it up, and Toys R Us did exist in 1969, but I don't know that it was part of the general vernacular.
Maybe.
Just gonna, we'll let them have that one, but it's
You also it were dicey. Confused about whether or not drag ball slang,
yes.
drag ball vernacular.
Did he say realness?
He used the word realness, and I
was given the benefit of the doubt.
The drag balls go back for
to the 20s,
decades.
Right?
Yes, yes, many years. But I don't know.
You were more suspicious of that one.
How commonly used words like that were among everybody.
Sure.
And so, like now. Thanks to Paris is Burning and right. RuPaul's Drag Race,
right.
people misuse the word realness
all the time.
Yeah, and so there are moments in the film where not only is it overarching sort of nonsensical and illogical, but there are moments that make you think, wait, is that a thing that people did or said? The hair looks weird.
Yeah, the hair doesn't look right all the time.
This is just a badly made film.
Yeah, it's very clumsy. And
so here comes the next day, right? They've rioted for one night.
Right.
And I got to say, I was also very disappointed in the quality of the riot.
Yeah.
This
is Roland Emmerich. Like, you'd think the explosions would be happening.
It begins, and I think, all right, great. The Titanic has begun to sink, and now the rest of the movie is going to be violence and fighting. Nope.
Mm-mm.
They riot for a little bit. Then the next morning, Ramona, says to Warhorse, things are changing now.
I can get a real job.
I can get a regular job, maybe. And I was like, wait, how?
And
did y'all get a non-discrimination ordinance through last night? Is that what happened?
And is it the person that... It's one of the generic and the rest characters. It's either the professor or Marianne. Then waltzes in and says, well, we got our rights now. It's kind of like, wait, you rioted once.
And there's still three more nights to go, apparently.
Yeah.
Two or three.
Which they don't even acknowledge in the film that, it kept going.
No. They do say in the end.
Well, the movie doesn't go back and show how the next nights rolled out. Because the movie then has to spend 20 minutes so that Warhorse can go back to Indiana on a bus from New York for the afternoon.
Okay, here's my favorite. My favorite thing.
To discover that quarterback has married and knocked up the girlfriend.
Yes.
And then plucky younger sister, who is annoyingly understanding throughout the entire film, played by Joey King.
Who I think Joey King is a wonderful little actress.
She's a swell actress.
She's been a child actress for years.
She was in Ramona and Divas.
She's still a child, actually.
Yeah. And she was in Oz, the Great and Powerful.
Yeah. And she's the voice of 2015.
Exactly.
She's the one who runs up to him. It's still 1969, by the way. She's the one who runs up to him and is like, do you have a boyfriend yet? Like, she's so into it.
Yeah.
And the mom
Fruit
who's been...
training.
The mom who has been so tight-lipped and uncool.
Unhelpful.
Yeah, during the entire film. The very next thing you see...
You're jumping ahead. First, she stands in the kitchen clutching her chest while son and daughter are having a heart-to-heart talk.
I'm just getting to the great part.
So then, we get to the one-year anniversary of the Stonewall Riots. It's the first Pride Parade in New York City.
I don't know that they called it a pride parade. No, I think they called it a protest march.
Like the gay liberation.
I don't think there were floats yet.
No. This was a political action. Yes.
B of A wasn't sponsoring their employees.
There was not a Budweiser truck.
Yeah. You see him walking down the street with all his pals, and they've all got signs mm-hmm. that say things like, you know, gay power and stuff like that. And then they cut to the side to the spectators, and there's the little sister, and there's the mom waving, like, hey, we're so happy. This with bizarre grin on the mother's face. This crazy sort of like kind of like freaked out grin on the mom's face. And they are acting as though they are watching this grand parade. And that there was the reason to travel from Indiana, you know, like someone's parents would come
in 1970
for this. And then
you get all these closing crawls about, you know, what happened to the real people and the statistics about the gay homeless youth and the number of countries around the world where it's still illegal to be gay. And you're thinking like, okay, I get that you were trying to get me all revved up for this.
Right.
But none of the movie up until these statistics did the trick.
Nothing. So historically weird. Written in a crazy way that
dramatically inept
doesn't make sense. Performances that are all over the place, from inert to leering and obnoxious. It all looks cheap and plastic and fake, and there's no sense of urgency.
No,
whatsoever.
This is not agitprop in any way.
No.
This is not a movie that is going to make you throw your fist in the air and want to like smash the state, which a good Stonewall movie should make you want to do.
Right. So watch Tangerine.
it's not out yet, but yeah. I mean,
Tangerine is in theaters now. If you live in a place that doesn't have an art house that Tangerine will not play in, you know.
It'll be out on DVD one of these days, and we'll tell you
all about
it.
You got Tangerine problems, I feel bad for you, son. It'll be out on DVD pretty soon, though.
Yeah, I think so.
Watch Tangerine.
Mm-hmm.
You want to see a movie where trans people are the heroes? Where they do amazing...
Where they have a voice?
Amazing things. Yeah, that's the one.
Totally. Okay, what else is this week?
Sicario.
Yes, you saw Sicario.
It opened very limited last week, six screens nationwide. Now it's expanding to, you know, a normal number of screens. It stars Emily Blunt as an agent for the DEA.
I think she's an FBI agent.
Oh, she's FBI?
Yeah.
One of them.
Yeah.
And she is drawn into an operation that will take her into Mexico to fight against the big cartels.
Right.
Her bosses, as it were, for this adventure are Josh Brolin and Benicio del Toro. And they recruit her for it without ever really explaining to her the nature of the mission.
Yes, or even who they are. They keep saying they're Department of Defense.
There's a lot of obfuscating going on.
Yeah, that they're advisors.
She accepts the task and then learns that she is way in over her head.
Yes.
And things are going from bad to horrible to inexplicable to worse. And here's why she's so perfect in this film. She never actually freaks out. You feel her freaking out inside, but she's so good at her job
mm-hmm.
that even though you can see it on her face, that she knows this is the very worst thing that could have happened to her.
And you can tell that she's trying to believe that somewhere in all of this, there lies a moral high ground that she can maintain.
And a legal one.
That too.
Yeah. Mm. There is not.
It is directed by Denis Villeneuve, the Canadian filmmaker behind Prisoners and Enemy and Incendie.
Yes.
Only one of which I've seen. And it's shot by the great Roger Deakins.
Yeah, it looks fantastic.
Looks amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, Blunt is great. Brolin and Del Toro are really good. It goes into weirdly dark places. I mean, there's an opening segment that seems like the standard kind of, you know, storming the compound scene you've seen a million times. It just goes into some really messed up places. Yeah, I like this movie a lot.
It's really good. It is well directed. It moves efficiently, not histrionically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't need to really see another drug war movie about why the drug war is useless.
But it never stops and tells you that.
Exactly. It kind of does toward the end, and that is where it's not perfect. I could have stood it to be a little more astringent.
Okay.
Because that's I prefer.
Yes.
But where I was going was that you didn't need to see another drug war film,
mm-hmm.
but this is a really good one.
No, totally.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's like we mentioned this that there's no genre that can't be vindicated by another good movie. That just when you think you are sick of X and you don't want to see another X, that you know a good one can come along and
Emily Blunt has built on her Edge of Tomorrow performance here.
I hadn't thought about that, but yeah,
you're right. And she's just so good in the film, and it's not until about halfway through that I thought, oh, I wonder if this was written for a woman.
In the first place.
I wonder what gender this character was originally supposed to be.
There's one development in the plot that I would say would...
Yes, there is.
Probably only work but with that, a character. But you could have done it some other way. Sure, yeah.
I like the fact that, you know, there's a female lead.
Yeah.
In this, you know, action movie.
And some great supporting cast. What's his face? Titanic guy.
Titanic.
The dad guy. On Alias.
Victor Garber.
Victor Garber. Thank you.
Oh, come on.
I blanked on his name.
How do you blank on his name?
Because I'm uncomfortably hot.
You watch Godspell every Easter.
I know.
And he's the Jesus in Godspell.
Anyway, Victor Garber, who is Emily Blunt's immediate superior, who has this amazing way of sort of conveying information without really conveying information.
Right.
Especially when it comes to like the nature of the mission that he's sending her on.
Yeah.
And John Bernthal, because John Bernthal is in everything now.
He's the new Oscar Isaac. He really is. He's like in everything.
Yeah.
And if you're not fully tuned into his presence, you
might not recognize him from movie to movie.
Recognize him from movie to movie. Yeah. The way it was with Oscar Isaac at first.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, is that, where have I seen that guy before? And then you go to IMDb and you're like, oh, he's been in everything. Yeah.
John Bernthal is that guy now.
Yeah.
Okay, Hotel Transylvania 2.
We can knock this out in 1 minute.
The big movie of the weekend. It's super fun, and I would be perfectly happy if Adam Sandler only did these from now on.
Well, yeah. It's more of the same.
Yes.
If you saw Hotel Transylvania with your children, I don't know of any other reason why you would have seen Hotel Transylvania other than that you might be an animation nerd. It's a finely animated film. It hits all the contemporary, you know, marks of animation. It's, you know, it's brightly colored and it looks good.
It's directed by Genndy Tartakovsky, the guy who created Dexter's Laboratory and Samurai Jack. And if you are...
Co-written by...
Robert Smigel and Adam Sandler.
And this is where its quality comes from. I really believe that Smigel is the MVP, probably.
Well,
of this,
Smigel... Well, you're a fan of Zohan. Smigel co-wrote that one, too. He's done other...
Well, yeah, because Zohan's kind of funny.
He's done other some live-action Sandler films as well. What I was going to say, if you are an animation nerd and you want to hear more from and about Genndy Tartakovsky, the B-Movies podcast interviewed him this week.
Yes.
We did a whole separate episode with him. So go check that out. But anyway, I laughed from start to finish. I really, you know...
Lots of sight gags, lots of fun verbal stuff, lots of cute, cool, visual... monstery things going on,
and oddly enough, I mean, structurally, this movie has a lot in common with the Grown Ups movies of all things.
Yeah,
in that you've got a lot of these sort of middle aged monsters, sort of trying to recapture their youth or find themselves being still relevant or whatever. You know, but they've been sort of beaten down by life. Like Steve Buscemi's werewolf has so many kids and is such a like just put upon husband and father that, you know, when he's trying to like stalk a deer in the woods to show his savagery, he winds up getting distracted by a frisbee.
Yes.
You know, just stuff like that. But the thing is, in the Grown Ups movies, there's such a sour and misanthropic undercurrent, whereas this movie, it's just kind of like, oh well, that's how life is, and then you laugh at it, and the laughs aren't bitter.
Right, that's because it's a children's film.
Well, exactly, but ostensibly, so is the. I mean, the Grown Ups movies are like PG.
Well, yeah, they're meant to be family movies, but they're so pukey that you don't. You wouldn't subject your family to it at all unless it was punishment.
But people out there do. They make money.
You know why that people do that?
Because they're dumb.
Because they're stupid. Yes. Yeah.
Anyway.
And we're talking about you, if you liked them. So, how you like us now? Yeah.
But yeah, even if you absolutely despise Adam Sandler and all other iterations, give him a shot in the Hotel Transylvania movies. They're really fun.
I saw The Intern. You did not.
I did not.
Robert De Niro plays an unpaid intern for Anne Hathaway's wildly successful, overnight successful clothing internet company.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of the unpaid internship is not critiqued in this film at all. And the reason it is not critiqued in this film at all is because everyone is rich. And the reason everyone is rich is because it is a Nancy Meyers film. We'll get to that later in about 30 seconds because I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. This is a cute and adorable film to take your mother to see, provided your mother likes things that are cute and adorable and not intellectually taxing at all. The story is basically that Anne Hathaway runs this company, and she's type A, and she's got everything under control. But, you know, she can't always quite keep the plates spinning exactly. She doesn't sleep very much. She falls asleep in the back of her car as the driver is taking her around. She signs
up. Did Myers write Baby Boom?
I don't remember.
I think so.
You might look that up. She doesn't remember signing off on the senior citizen intern program. She doesn't want there to be a senior citizen intern program, and yet here comes one anyway. And along with it comes Robert De Niro, who is the most competent of all of them because he spent 40 years running a company that made telephone books.
Aha.
Cue all the jokes from all the, you know, millennial age.
What's a telephone?
What's a telephone? Those are old-timey things. Yeah. Okay, so.
I used to turn whale blubber into lantern fuel.
Right. And the story here, though, is she, like I said the other day on Press Play, this story allows Nancy Meyers to tell two stories. One story is an old person whose ideas and experience and wisdom is valued.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a thing that, you know, we're going to hear more and more about, I think, as the baby boomers get even older. They're going to be all like, hey, remember us?
And we're so relevant.
And we're all going to say, yeah, we remember you.
You go to bed, old man.
You've never stopped talking.
You've sucked all the oxygen out of the room and the planet.
But there is a point to be made here, and it's a point the film doesn't make, but I'll make it.
Okay.
Generations are marketing terms.
You always say that. I don't know that it's true.
I believe it's true. I believe this is a fact, and I believe it's a very true thing. I believe that what separates us is far less significant than what we have in common in terms of age. I really feel like the culture, and particularly the media, loves to pit generations against one another. You know, and it's a way for generations to feel like they have a group identification, and it's a way for people to be sold things more efficiently, and it's a way to dismiss and ignore the way people from different age brackets use or mistreat one another. You know, the baby boomers, you know, they crap on the millennials, but they've ruined things that they were supposed to fix, and now the millennials are going to pay for it. And then I turn around and watch an episode of Louie where the 24-year-old kitchen shop owner berates him and condescends to him because he is 48 years old. And she's incredibly snotty to him about how he's old and in the way, and someone 24 is inherently smarter than someone who's 48, and he should be happy about that and get out of the way. And I see these both ends of the spectrum.
Which was written by a 48-year-old, incidentally.
It was. But I think to myself, none of this is real. This all feels like a game that we've all been told we have to play. And I just don't like participating in it.
But see, I think that's simplistic. I mean, you know, no. when you look at, for instance, like that whole meme of the 70s dad.
Yes.
You know, there genuinely was a difference between baby boomers and what things cost and what their opportunities were as opposed to
that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the circumstances that confronted each generation as they entered adulthood.
But the circumstances create a generation. I think they create expectations of what the world will offer and what our part in participating is supposed to be. I think that generations exist because they are molded by circumstance. The reason that the baby boomers exist is because they didn't go to World War II, for instance. You know, that's and they were raised in a very specific set of circumstances where there was indeed a baby boom. So there was this population explosion. So we were leaving the cities and branching out to the suburbs, and the suburbs wound up being, you know, culturally desiccated. And then that's why the beatniks happened, and then the hippies happened, and all that stuff. I think that this stuff comes from somewhere. It's not just a way to sell crap.
I'm not saying that there are not differences, or that circumstances are not the same, mm-hmm. and that those circumstances reacted to by the new generation. I'm not saying that that stuff doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that if you are a thoughtful person, if you are an aware person, if you are a conscious person, you are seeing through that stuff. You are learning from all kinds of people. You are learning from older people. You are learning from younger people. You are befriending older people.
Well, sure.
You are befriending younger people. And you are understanding the world through their experience as well as through your own. And if you stay locked within your own little, you know, demographic enclave, then you are part of the problem and you are playing into the hands of the people who want to control you.
Okay, well, I agree with all that, but that's not the same as saying generations don't exist, they're created as a
marketing tool. I was speaking broadly.
Okay, well, you're backpedaling now, so...
I'm not backpedaling. I'm merely laying out my ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So, you just...
I think you're trying to be provocative, but then as soon as somebody asks a question, then you suddenly things get more delineated. That's
listen,
what you're doing.
Listen, Generation X scum. I'll have you know.
You are an Xer, too.
That I am also there.
But we have older friends and we have younger friends. So.
Okay, so She's trying to tell two stories.
Yes, okay, right. Old people have something valuable to contribute. Old people have something
valuable to contribute. And women should not be punished for trying to do all the things they want to do in their life. Hmm. Most films starring Anne Hathaway involve Anne Hathaway being punished in some way. Mm-hmm. And here's one that does not. There's a plot development that takes place in the second half of the movie that makes me wish that she had allowed, that her character was allowed to become a little more furious. Mm-hmm. That does not happen. But that means that I'm expecting this film to act like real life when it is not meant to be real life.
It is a Nancy Myers movie.
It is a Nancy Myers movie where people are swaddled in luxury and comfort. And no one's primary needs are being denied.
Nancy Myers, in case people don't know, is the woman behind It's Complicated and Something's Gotta Give and other...
The Holiday.
Other Donna Karen designed Crate and Barrel catalog layouted movies.
She creates incredibly attractive cocoons of comfort and luxury and well-being. And here's what I like about her. Kindness. Mm. People ultimately in her films, they wind up happy and they wind up being kind to each other.
Actually,
and I'm kind of into that. I know that sounds like soft and mushy, but I'm kind of down for that.
She and her then husband Charles Shire, they used to collaborate on stuff. Did the Parent Trap remake?
Yeah,
which is also, I think, a movie about people's better selves.
All right, very quickly.
Yes.
Bump through 99 Homes and The Death of Superman Lives.
Okay.
Quick.
Okay, 99 Homes, it's Ramin Barani, who, if you have been following indie film, he did these really great little scrappy indies like Chop Shop and Man Push Cart. A couple of years ago, he attempted to do a bigger canvas movie about, you know, the plight of the modern American farmer called At Any Price with Dennis Quaid and Zac Efron and my buddy Kim Dickens.
Yeah, Kim Dickens.
Yay. And it was not so hot. Kim Dickens was great. The movie didn't really all work. Now, this one, 99 Homes, I think is more successful. It stars Andrew Garfield as a guy who works construction, but it's 2010 and the recession is in full gear and he's not able to get work. And his home is repossessed and he is tossed out along with his young son, and his mother is played by Laura Dern. Turns out the only job that he can get, the only game in town to get any kind of work, is to go work for the guy who repossessed his house, played by Michael Shannon.
Boo!
Who works with the banks
but
to,
Michael
like,
Shannon, yay!
Yeah. Who works with the banks to boot people out of their houses, and of course the whole system is rigged, and it's all screwing over the little guy, and the banks and are in cahoots with the government to just, like, you know, destroy everyone's life. And the movie is very damning about this actual thing, this that whole period of people, the mass evictions that were going on and the foreclosures and all that stuff that was happening. And I think it presents it really well, and those two lead performances are really great, especially Michael Shannon. And then the movie has a failure of nerve in the last, like, 10 minutes that just drove me up the wall and ruins the whole movie for me.
Should I still go see it?
You should still go see it.
All right.
And then we'll, you know, maybe one day when we start when we have the all spoiler episode, where we go back and talk about all the movies we didn't talk about on the show because we didn't want to give them away, we'll talk about the ending of 99 Homes, because it really just drove me up the wall. But up until that point, it's really good, so it's worth seeing with the caveat of they really don't nail the ending.
Right.
The Death of Superman Lives, What Happened, is a documentary about the movie Superman Lives that was supposed to happen in the 90s. Kevin Smith wrote the original screenplay for it. Tim Burton was slated to direct. Nicolas Cage was going to play him. Maybe you've seen the picture of, like, a long, dark-haired Nicolas Cage wearing, like, this weird sort of blue kind of, like, rubbery Superman suit. If you're interested in documentaries about movies that didn't get made, this is a pretty good one because... You know, it's amazing how much money gets spent on films that don't get made, because you see all of this, like, concept art that got created and various iterations of the costumes that got created and all this effort that got put into it. The problem with the movie is the guy directing it isn't really a director. And one of the things that he bobbles is he does all of the interviews and he talks to Tim Burton, he talks to Kevin Smith, he talks to John Peters, who was going to be the executive producer. You know, a lot of these people... But he talks to them on camera. So a lot of times you'll get a two shot and it'll be Tim Burton talking and then this guy sitting next to him nodding and nodding. And it's really distracting after a while. And you wish that like some an actual documentary filmmaker who knew how to set up a shot and do frame an interview had made this movie.
Right.
It is pretty much of strictly of nerd appeal. Like if the idea of this movie doesn't immediately make you go, ooh, I want to see that, you don't want to see it. But if you are like a comic book person and somebody who's really into superheroes and that kind of thing, or who's into like, you know, these great projects that were much discussed and talked about and then never came to fruition and you wonder why that was, you know, this is a pretty interesting peek behind the curtain of this very ambitious film that never got off the ground. It is available on demand, so I think wherever you are, you can see it.
You know what's great?
What's great?
Eating other humans alive.
Oh.
That's what's great. Gouging out their eyeballs with sticks and then slicing off their tongues and eating it and everyone going, yay, and jumping up and down. That's what's great.
That's, no. No thank you. No thank you. Not tonight in Vegas.
I saw Green Inferno,
mm-hmm.
the new Eli Roth film. And when I say new, I mean 2 years old.
I was going to say new in quotes, right?
It's been finished for a very long time. It was held from release for a very long time. There's I don't some remember legal stuff. Some legal kind
yeah,
of thing.
You know, I assigned a review for it at the Wrap, only to discover that we had reviewed it.
You had already reviewed
back
it.
Back in the day, Todd Gilchrist saw it at Fantastic Fest.
Right. it stars a Chilean actress named Lorenza Izzo. She is Mrs. Eli Roth. Remember how back in the day when you were, like, when we, even this was still the holdover, even when you and I were little kids, how some women would identify themselves as Mrs. Bernard blah, blah.
Not just when we were little kids. I think I've told this story on the show before. When I was working at the Nashville Banner in 1988, after I had graduated from college, the woman who ran the society page was trying to sort of segue into using women's first names.
Yes.
And the older Nashville ladies were like, no one will know who I am.
Yeah.
People know me as Mrs. John E. Bailey III.
Right.
Not as, you know,
Irene.
Francine or whatever. Yeah.
Right.
So, no, that was, that went on for a long time.
Okay, so anyway, Lorenza Izzo is married to Eli Roth.
Yes.
She stars as one of a crew of dumb college students who are rainforest activists, and they travel down to the Amazon, to the rainforest, ostensibly to stop the clearing of the forest. Although, their leader, who is also a student, he doesn't really tell them that really he just wants to make it a photo op and a publicity stunt, that they're not really going to do any good by going down there. And that's a bit of a spoiler, but it's not the point. It's if there's a moral point to the film, that's it. And
but it's a way to tar all progressives with the brush of being self-serving.
Sure.
Thanks, Eli Roth.
So what? And so they find a village there. Well, actually, the village finds them.
Their plane crashes, right?
Their plane crashes, and the villagers find them, and they take them all, and they put them in a cage, and then one by one, they eat them. Ta-da!
Is there a story to this?
Eaten is the story. And then, you know, people trying to escape.
Ah.
And being caught. And getting eaten. Now.
Hoop-de-doo.
I've said this before. I said it on Madeline Brand's show this past week, and I said it, I think, on this very podcast before. The thrill of horror is the friction that exists in your own mind between cheering on the person who is trying to escape the killer, and then when they are caught, cheering the killer.
I think that's just you.
No.
I think that's just you because you're
despicable. There's a thrill. There is a thrill. If you are a horror fan, if you love horror, there is a thrill in watching the person get it. There's a thrill in watching the killer do the killing. That's fun. That's entertainment. That is the whole punchline of the story of that I've told already once before about being sort of confronted by a group of other film critics who were complaining about Hostel. Okay, an earlier Eli Roth film, saying that it was vile and despicable and torture porn and all those other things. And I stayed silent, and one of them turned to me and said, "You haven't said a word. And you like this sort of stuff, don't you? I think I've heard you talk about it before. Why do you like this?" My answer was, I like watching people get their heads chopped off. It's fun. You know what else is fun? Watching people get eaten alive. Chopped up, cooked, eaten. It's gore and guts for its own sake. And I find it extremely entertaining.
I will never understand this facet of you. I have no interest in
the main complaint about this film is that they feel as though that it's racist, in that the people who played the villagers are an actual Peruvian village of people who they participated in the film. They allowed themselves to be painted blood red for a reason that is never explained. We just assume that they paint their skin red with the blood of their victims. And that
because there aren't any bugs in the rainforest, and that'd be all over that.
By doing so, that the film sort of others them, and
the question of whether or not they even knew what they were signing up for, since they'd never seen a movie before,
and lends them well. But he, you know, according to the internet research I've done, Eli Roth was like, "Here's what we're doing. This is, you know, it is a movie, and we make movies, and it's you're going to be in the movie, and you're going to play a different person, you know, all that stuff." The idea of, and this is historically valid, I mean, old films that depicted, you know, I'll use this word in quotes, tribal people being savage and uncivilized, you know, it's a way that historically we have used to
demonize
and oppress and
colonize
you know, folks. I really feel like a movie like this, which has it as its intention, first of all, to be an homage to films like Cannibal Holocaust and Cannibal Ferox and a lot of other films in the Italian cannibal genre, which are all listed in the credits, as a matter of fact, at the end. I feel like that was the main intention. Now, there are film critics out there this week, I've been reading reviews, who've said, then this is a genre that should go away. And maybe it should. Maybe it shouldn't. Personally, I did not feel a sense of, you know, outrage over the depiction of the villagers, primarily because they had all the power in the film. They were the ones who decided who lived and who died. And they were the ones whose lives were being encroached upon by these two groups of people, by the foresting companies and by the college students who were coming down to be all like, "We're going to save you," you know? And because it is a horror film, in my mind, the killers, they're the heroes. The cannibals are the heroes. Eat everybody. The end. And that is how I feel about this film. I love a good horror movie that's full of gore and guts.
We don't have time for me to unpack all the arguments I have against everything you just said.
Give me a few of them, quickly.
Okay,
I probably won't even try to refute your arguments because we're running out of time.
Why are we supposed to defend a movie where we're supposed to believe that you know, white North American college students deserve to be punished for trying to help indigenous peoples, as though there were some inherent messiah complex in just wanting to bring attention to a problem and, you know, use whatever tools they have to their capacity to be of assistance?
The film depicts them as ill-prepared for this task. Enthusiasm, yes. Smarts, no.
And would it have treated them differently had they done their homework more?
It wouldn't have been a movie.
Oh, God. whatever. This just sounds like garbage, and I'm glad I didn't see it, and I'm never going to. And I think less of you for liking it. Letters?
I am not pro-racism. I am merely pro-eating human beings alive.
All right, your idea that somehow the natives are, the indigenous people are empowered because they're eating other people, because they're the monsters of this monster movie, I don't buy that. They're monsters. They're being turned into monsters. They're being depicted as inhuman or subhuman.
I considered them to be simply hungry.
What's your DVD?
And look, dinner just showed up. Look, it got, we called in delivery. A whole, it's like 12 pizzas showing up at your house all at once. Look, I can eat pizza for the next 12 nights.
What's your DVD?
There's a great shot of a little toddler carrying a severed arm out of a group of people. That's probably my favorite moment in the film.
What's your DVD pick? I'm not even talking about this anymore. What's your DVD pick?
It is a gay film from 1971 called Some of My Best Friends Are.
Mm.
We've probably talked about this movie before on the show.
Perhaps.
I'm sure we have. It's set in a gay bar on Christmas Eve. And it is more gritty and realistic and authentic than anything in Stonewall. It stars Fanny Flagg, Rue McClanahan,
Gil Gerard, Gary Sandy,
Candy Darling is in it.
Carlton Carpenter.
Yeah. It is unavailable.
It has never been released on home video. It aired on Logo once or twice in the early days of that network.
But the entire film is on YouTube.
Yay!
Yep.
This movie's bananas, and it is so steeped in self-loathing.
Yes.
It's shocking. Although, as even Vito Russo points out in Celluloid Closet, it was considered offensive when it came out, and now it's just epically tacky.
I, again, not to be a contrarian, I don't see it that way. I see it as a document of a moment. And in 1971, post-Stonewall, you still, you know,
there was a lot of self-loathing.
Had limited options. And so I feel like, I'll quote Harvey Fierstein, representation at any cost.
Sure.
And that is how I feel about this movie.
I just don't know that the people making it, I don't even know if anybody gay made this movie. So, like, I don't know if it's just gawking.
Right.
You know, or if it's meant to be actually
irrelevant
a representation
to me.
Of things. Anyway.
Where it comes from is kind of irrelevant to me.
Well, I think it matters.
It matters until it doesn't.
You should still see it. It's a movie worth seeing anyway. You won't believe it.
Yeah.
And it's a Christmas movie, so, you know.
It
bonus,
is, yeah.
Bonus
it is a,
on that.
It's a Christmas film.
It's in my book.
The most depressing Christmas ever.
I think there's more worse ones out there, but it's definitely in the running. I feel like I've been recommending the 1995 Stonewall movie all over the place this week. So my DVD pick this week will actually be Milos Forman's Hair. Again, a movie I thought of several times while watching Stonewall. A much better movie about hippies and countercultural people in New York City in the late 1960s in the Vietnam era, and a very successful musical. I've actually never seen the stage version, which I understand is...
I've never seen the stage version either, but,
different. But
this
the
film
very,
version is pretty great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Letters?
Letter. We have time for a letter.
Ein letter. Okay.
This is from David.
Okay.
Dave, I always love your analysis of Christian movies. And during last week's discussion about the latest God films, I had what you might call a revelation. It occurred to me that most of the recently released Christian movies have a miracle at the core of their story. War Room features a cheating husband's miraculous reformation that comes as a result of his wife's prayer. Captive is about a murderer and kidnapper who is called to release his hostage after considering the spiritual writings of Rick Warren. And 90 Minutes in Heaven's protagonist is brought back to life through the power of prayer. It's not surprising that the Christian filmmaking community has discovered the, quote, Jesus is magic formula to making profitable films. After all, this is exactly what Hollywood has been feeding us almost since the beginning, most recently with the glut of superhero movies. In Hollywood, the hero always beats the bad guy, gets the girl, and stops the bomb from going off. Similarly, Christian filmmakers are basically telling us, if you pray hard and believe enough, God will save you from adultery, abduction, death, everything. It's clear by now that they are not interested in any realistic depiction of faith. It made me wonder how they might depict the recent Charleston Emanuel Church shootings or the Catholic Church's sex scandal. Where was their hero God in those situations? The answer came to me in the form of my own little personal revelation one day when I heard an interview with a relative of one of the victims in the Charleston shootings. She told the interviewer that she had already forgiven the man who killed her relative in cold blood, and she had returned to worshiping in the same church where the murders happened. I realized that real faith most often does not result in miracles, but it does often provide people with the ability to forgive and move on with their lives. Which brings me to my question for both of you. Can you think of any films that provide realistic and diverse points of view about religion, or even about faith or spirituality in the general sense, without descending into annoying, saccharine, everything will be okay type scenarios? One example I could think of, even though it's not technically a movie, is the recent Olive Kitteridge on HBO, which dealt with normal everyday tragedies and the way in which average humans struggle to move past the tragic events and continue with their lives.
Okay, so what's the question? I mean, is it
why do you hate cannibalism?
No. is it movies that deal with spirituality in a non-ooky way, or movies that deal with people overcoming tragedy?
Movies that deal with spirituality in a realistic way.
I thought, and I've mentioned this on the show, I thought the Christian character in Z for Zachariah was really interestingly handled that she was... It was important to her, and it was something that kept her going. But she wasn't gross about it, and she was pragmatic enough to allow the church to be dismantled to create this water wheel that would generate electricity.
I go back to the same ones over and over.
Bresson.
I'm getting to that. Okay. I go back to the same ones over and over. I go back to Bridge to Terabithia, of all things.
Oh, right, yes,
a kids movie that involves really strong messages about faith and doubt, and there's a child atheist in the film. Mm-hmm. There's a child Christian in the film who's terrified of Jesus. It's a really unusual movie that was overlooked, and I don't think people knew quite what to do with it. And it came out like 10 years in the past 10 years.
Yeah.
Anna Sophia Robb,
based on a book that a lot of people younger than us read in high school or junior high.
I go back to The Apostle, the Robert Duvall film about the preacher who's obsessed with Jesus, but has strong personal demons conflicting his life. You keep trying to get me to watch the thing that
Ground.
I keep not watching, and I do need to get to that.
Vera Farmiga's film about a woman who is part of a very strict Christian sect who begins to realize that her role as a woman in the church is very strictly conscribed, and that she wants to have more of a role in the spirituality of the community.
And yes, The Diary of a Country Priest. Hmm. Which is Bresson.
And Jesus Donkey.
And, Ojasar Baltasar is sort of metaphorically about the life of Christ. But it's not about faith, necessarily.
Percent.
But Diary of a Country Priest really is. And it's based on the Bernanos book of the same title, which is equally and even more detailed and
And I'm sure there are some Ingmar Bergman movies about God's silence that I haven't watched that would fall into this category.
Yeah.
But there's stuff out there for sure.
All right, the end. We got to go.
Okay. As always, we thank you so much for listening. And quick reminder that we will soon be recording our Gentlemen Prefer Blondes commentary episode. In the meantime, you can purchase any of our previous commentary track episodes, including What's Up, Doc?, The Poseidon Adventure, Two for the Road, Josie and the Pussycats, Clue, The Apple, White Christmas, Santa Claus. They are $1.99 each. You can PayPal us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Let us know where you want that sent, and we'll get it over to you. Check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Listen to the B-Movies podcast, The Schmoes Know, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, the Bret Easton Ellis podcast, the Joe L. Ryan thing, The Sewers of Paris, Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion cast, Film Spotting SVU, The Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free on iTunes. Please leave us a review. It does help people find the show. I forgot to look this week to see if we got new reviews, but we always appreciate them when we get them, and it does help us out in standing out amidst the morass of podcasts that are available out there.
There's like 700 film podcasts.
Yeah, it's insane. Yeah. You can also stream the program for free at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com and leave us positive feedback there. Or you can stream us on the app on our Facebook page, Linoleum Knife Podcast. Please go like us. You can also join our Linoleum Knife group page to talk about movies with other fans of the show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at LinoleumCast. And again, our email address is linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We do have some lovely letters that we'll get caught up in the next couple of weeks, but feel free to drop us a line in the meantime.
The loveliest of letters.
Yes. And hey, we...
And a few love letters.
Yes. Well, speaking of which, Dave and I will be celebrating our 20th anniversary.
Oh, yeah, that's
week.
Right. When is that happening?
It's this week. It's coming up in the next...
What?
It's before we do our next podcast.
Oh.
I know.
What day is the first?
I think it's Wednesday.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you have any screenings that night? You have to ditch it.
I'll see what I can do.
It's not Tuesday night, is it, when you're teaching?
No, it's Wednesday. Okay. So there's that.
Yeah, we got to go eat a lot of food and celebrate our love.
That's right. All right. Well, we thank you for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.